Talk Show.
Recorded live.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, the program automatically went to start, and I guess we're rolling. It was not my intention. Usually, I have to wait for hit the start button before I go. And in this case, I dialed in and it started. So here we are, being recorded live. This is the very first installment of Christogenos, which is the discussion. It's going to be an ongoing discussion of primarily the New Testament, but also the Old Testament, relating to the fact that the 12 tribes of Israel, who are today represented by the Anglo-Saxon, Celtic, and Caucasian people, are the true Israelites of the Bible, and we are the holy seed of the Bible. And we're instituting this program to counter all of the universalistic propaganda and false teaching that has certainly come about primarily since the age of the televangelists, since the Jewish-sponsored televangelists have been preaching that the Jews are God's chosen people, which we know is absolutely false, and that when the Bible is really understood and carefully read, you cannot possibly believe that, okay? And so we're going to be addressing both that issue, that is, who the true Israelites really are, plus all of the universalistic interpretations of Scripture, many of which absolutely fail to treat Scripture honestly, nor carefully, nor diligently, nor with any sense of historicity of what actually has transpired, as this book, the Holy Bible, has been given to us by the Hebrew prophets and the Israelites, our ancestors. I see Bill Fink is on with me. Bill, you there?
Hello, Eli, and praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh. Would you like to make an introductory statement?
Oh, no, that's okay. I'm not really one for introductory statements.
Okay.
Your job.
All right. Okay, so let me just say first, before we get into today's theme, which is going to be the vision that Peter had about the clean and unclean meats in the book of Acts, I first have to issue an apology to Mark Downey. A week ago Monday, I was on a Sword Brethren show, Come Out of Her, My People, and he was complaining about the lack of, moderation by the moderators of the Stormfront.com, which is a really great blog site. And it has bloggers that are of all persuasions, pagans, primarily white nationalists, pagans, identity, and probably some Judeo-Christians even, I would imagine. And he was having great difficulty with the present moderator, whose name I don't know, and also the former moderator, which was Mark Downey's wife. And there was a lot of bad blood between Brian and those two moderators. And I commented, and offhandedly, and it sounded like it was in bad taste. I said, Mark Downey needs to get his house in order. Well, at the time, I thought that Mark Downey was actually the person who ran that site, and I just assumed that because his wife was the moderator for quite a long time. And so when I said Mark Downey needs to get his house in order, he must have assumed that I meant his actual household and what I was referring to was the website and the fact that the moderators were taking a very staunch anti-two-seed line position, which, of course, is what I believe and a lot of others in Christian identity believe to be true, a true interpretation of Genesis 3:15. So, Mark, I'm sorry if you took that personally. I should have known better even to say anything like that, but it was not meant to imply that your home and your relationship with your wife needs to be reconstructed. I was talking about the website and the fact that the moderators are not being quite as judicious as they should be. Now I understand it's not your fault at all. You haven't had anything to do with that. And so now I understand why you took that comment personally. because I mistakenly thought that you were the person who ran that website. So again, my apologies, Mark. You're definitely a good Christian man, and I have your article on the flood of Noah, the fact that the flood of Noah was not global, on my website. I've had it there for a very long time, and that's a great piece of work. So again, my apologies, Mark. I'm sure we can straighten this out. So I'd just like to say one more thing, though, on the subject of two seed line. It's the hot button issue of Christian identity. When we formed the Council of Elders in the year 2003, we took a vote deciding we asked the question, should we include non-seedliners as council members? And even though everyone there present, the 24 men, were all two seedliners. And if you go to our website, anglo-saxonisrael.com, the opening statement there says, we were all two seedliners, and we came together because we were two seedliners. But we asked the question, should we exclude, good Christian men who are not two seedliners? And I think there was only one person who voted against it. I think it was probably Clifton Emmaheiser.
I would have joined him.
Okay. But we decided that there's, most of these people are fair-minded, and they simply have been misinformed. That was our approach to it. And then if there's a Christian man who understands that the Jews are really the enemies of true Israel, the enemies of the white race, and doesn't totally agree with us on the two-seed line issue, well, then he's certainly on the right track, and we weren't going to reject him, over that issue. So that's the stance we took. And I've pretty much, acted that way ever since. And there's a lot of, anti-seedliners out there who are just as adamant in their position as we are in ours, And so I look at it this way. It's one of those issues that Jesus said, I would rather you be cold or hot. If you are lukewarm, I will spew thee out of my mouth. And, we're going to be probably arguing this till the judgment day. And that's a good thing, because it brings up issues that very, very few people are willing to talk about. Sooner or later, anybody who comes into Christian identity is going to hear about two seed line, and they're going to ask the question, do these people really believe that Eve had sex with the devil? And the answer to that is yes, that's exactly what we believe. Or one of his fallen angels, and the term used in Genesis 3:15 is Nakash, who was the whisperer, the enchanter, the deceiver, okay? So that's pretty much the position that we two seedliners take. And, we, like I said, we'll probably be debating this until the judgment day. And then we will find out for sure, won't we, Bill? All right, you there?
We should probably plan a future installment, and I would really like to discuss Genesis 1, Genesis 3.
Yeah.
Genesis 6, I would really like to discuss them at great length.
Absolutely.
Without an opposing view being present.
Right.
Not because I'm afraid of opposing views, I'm certainly not.
Mm-hmm.
But because two seed line, even by many two seed line advocates, is poorly understood.
Right.
It's not that they've only studied it to a given point and they've stopped there, or they haven't done their studying at all, but they believe it.
Right.
I mean, when you look at history, at the history of our race, at the history of the Jews,
right,
to me, that proves two seed line.
That's right.
That proves the enmity between two sets of people that constantly manifests itself in history everywhere.
That's right.
Everywhere those two sets of people are, that enmity is manifested.
Exactly.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
And I grew up in a land of a million Jews, and I sense that enmity all the time.
Right.
My entire life.
Yes. Yes.
All of the merchants in Jersey City were Jews, or
mm-hmm.
Well, until maybe the 1980s when the Arabs and the Indians.
Right. Exactly.
And the Jews,
and the Jews were behind importing them, too.
Absolutely.
Yes.
But I sense this enmity all my life personally.
Right.
And I feel as if I know it firsthand.
Yes, absolutely. I feel the same way.
And
yes.
In all of my reading, I mean, the Jews were thrown out of the Rhineland, my ancestral homeland.
Uh-huh.
They were thrown out of the Rhineland at the end of the 10th century or the end of the 11th century.
Right.
They were thrown out of France. They were thrown out of England. They were thrown out of Constantinople in the 4th century.
Right.
They've been thrown out of everywhere. There's always problems.
Yeah. Any country they've been thrown out of, that country has been better off upon their being thrown out.
Absolutely.
Yes.
The history alone proves the truth of Genesis 3:15, and this is genetic.
Yeah, and
I don't think that the opposing people, especially, not all two seed line advocates understand two seed line, but the opposing sectors in Christian identity definitely don't understand two seed line. They're just against it because they think that it's a lot of spiritual hocus pocus with devils with horns and pitchforks running around Eden, and that's the way it was explained to them, maybe, and they haven't thought it out well for that reason.
Yes.
And they've just rejected it on its face.
Right. Well, even Charles Wiseman, who is an opponent of two seed line, admits that Jesus Christ is definitely the descendant of one of those seed lines. Okay?
Absolutely.
He admits that. What he denies is that Eve also cohabited with someone besides Adam. Okay? He does not want to admit that. But for me, there's good spiritual and moral reasons otherwise Eve has to be impugned as having evil within herself. Okay? So, that's what they actually believe, you know? And so our standpoint is that no, evil came into her from an outside source. Okay? And to me, that's the crux of the theological issue, you know? So absolutely, let's plan a show on that topic. And then what we can also do is show that the New Testament authors, and certainly the early church fathers, you know, Clifton Emenheiser has done yeoman's work on this subject, it's obvious that the early church fathers believed that Eve was seduced as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
In fact, even I have to go to a modern source. Adolf Hitler in Mein Kampf states that Adam was thrown out of the Garden of Eden for race mixing.
Yes. He
understood two seed line.
Mm-hmm.
I have a paper, Shemitic Idioms in Genesis chapter 3, that I think proves beyond doubt that in the contemporary literature of the period that the book of Genesis was written, and I'm talking about ancient Assyrian literature, specifically the Epic of Gilgamesh, the idioms, the lines that have to do with becoming as gods and becoming aware and gaining knowledge.
Right.
They have to do with sexual awakening.
Yes.
There's no doubt. Read my paper. There is no doubt that those lines have to do with sexual awakening, and that's how they're used explicitly in the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Okay.
Which was written and circulated as literature at the same time that Moses was writing the books of the Pentateuch.
Right.
And the Assyrians are a kindred people. They're Semites, too.
Right.
And they would have the same idioms. They had a very similar language. They just wrote it in cuneiform.
Right.
And there's absolutely symbology in Genesis chapter 3 that proves that it was all about sex. It's a parable about sex.
Yeah. And the fact that the Israelites were always trying to be an exclusive people, Yahweh totally commanded them not to intermarry with the Canaanites, especially not the Canaanites, okay? And Ezra and Nehemiah kicked out all the priests who engaged in interracial marriage with non-Israelites. The books just plainly state this. It can hardly be misunderstood.
And the scripture makes it very plain that these Canaanites, that these people in the land of Canaan that weren't Adamites were the descendants. There's only one other source for people.
Yes.
An Adamite.
Yes.
Or you trace back to the Rephaim.
Right.
The so-called fallen angels.
The Kenites, K-E-N-I-T-E-S, which means the sons of Cain. Right. Exactly.
Absolutely.
Yes. But, okay, yeah, let's definitely do a show on that because there are a lot of, people who have written articles in favor of two seed line. And as you say, they make statements that maybe cannot be supported by scripture and supported by true scholarship. And often those works are criticized by anti-seedliners. And of course, if somebody makes a poor argument, that makes the rest of us look bad, So let's do a show and clarify this, okay?
I would love to.
Yeah. Okay. I just want to make one more quick point. And I looked up the New Testament Greek lexicon, the word genos, and the definition of that is kindred. Okay. Sub-definitions being offspring, family, stock, tribe, nation. Under stock, tribe, and nation, it says, for example, nationality or descent from a particular people. Okay. Letter D. The aggregate of many individuals of the same nature, kind, sort. This is a modern lexicon which does not want to use the word race.
Right, okay. Putting it at every possibility.
Exactly. But definitely offspring, kindred, family, stock, tribe, nation. That's what the Bible's talking about, okay? And that's why in following the pattern of your website, Christogenia, I decided to call this talk show Christogenos. And in the KGV, it actually uses the word genos two times to mean born, once to mean diversity, which is really strange, five times to mean kind, three times kindred, three are categorized as miscellaneous, two are categorized as nation, three offspring, and two stock. Okay, so, in the NAS, I don't know what that version that is, it uses the word race three times out of 19 instances. So in the NAS version of the scriptures, it does actually use the word race, as does the Farrar Fenton version of the Bible. He uses the word race for genos on many occasions, okay? So, ladies and gentlemen, when we're talking about the race of Christ Jesus, we are his kindred people, and we are the race of Israel, okay? So let's get to today's show, the subject being the vision that Peter had about the clean and unclean meat. But you want to preface, and this is contained in chapter 10 of Acts, you want to preface this discussion by citing a previous chapter.
Right. I decided this afternoon I wanted to preface it by citing two previous chapters.
Okay.
If I may.
Sure.
And the first one is Acts chapter 6. A lot of people think that the Ethiopian eunuch of Acts chapter 8 was an Ethiopian.
Yeah, right.
And that's certainly not true.
Okay. He lived in Ethiopia, but he was not an Ethiopian by race.
Peter's vision is the ideal scripture to speak about when you want to point out that a lot of mainstream pastors, ministers, teachers, whatever, who take a verse or two out of the Bible,
right,
out of context,
exactly,
and they just run with it.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes down to whether or not we should eat swine,
yes,
which I certainly don't advocate,
mm-hmm,
and I don't eat,
yep,
they point to Acts chapter 10 and Peter's vision and say, see, we could eat all the foods.
Right.
And Acts chapter 10 has nothing to do with food.
That's
at
right.
all.
It's a vision to begin with. You know.
It's a vision, and yeah, that means that it's in symbols.
That's right.
And we have to look at the context it was written in and that it occurred in,
yeah,
to understand it.
Exactly. Yes.
And we're going to go to Peter's vision actually tells him to accept uncircumcised people.
Right.
And we're going to establish that a little later.
Yes.
But first I'd like to look at Acts chapter 6 and 8,
mm-hmm,
at the Ethiopian eunuch and at the Hellenists, or Grecians, as the King James translates the word.
Okay.
Acts chapter 6, and in my translation it starts, and in those days with the multiplying of students, there was a murmuring among the Hellenists towards the Hebrews.
Okay.
This is not distinguishing Greeks or Grecians,
mm-hmm,
and Judeans.
Right.
This is distinguishing two different sorts of Judeans.
That's right.
Those who clung to Greek customs and those who clung to Hebrew customs.
Okay. Yes.
All these people were circumcised. They were all Judeans. They were all obviously Christians, so we know there probably weren't any Edomites in the group.
Yes.
And the proof of the fact that they're all Judeans is the one exception. In mm-hmm. Chapter 6, verse 5, it says, Nicholas, a convert or a proselyte of or from Antioch.
right.
and the octave.
Right.
And if you read Clifton Emmaheiser's special notice to all who deny 2C line number 8,
mm-hmm.
and this isn't related to 2C line, but he quotes John Lightfoot.
Okay.
And John Lightfoot was a very excellent biblical commentator who wrote his commentaries based on the Talmud, the writings of the Pharisees and
right.
the Talmud, and other assorted Hebrew writings. And he describes at length how the Judeans at the time were converting people to Judaism
yes.
by baptizing them
okay.
and immersing them in water and circumcising them.
Mm-hmm.
And after baptism and circumcision, those rites enabled them to become full-blooded Judeans.
Yes.
No matter what race they were.
Yes. Okay, that's what the Jews were doing, not
that's
the Christians.
What the Jews were doing, not the Christians.
Yes.
And this helps explain John's baptism as that ritual cleansing, but John's baptism was only for Israelites.
Right.
It wasn't for serpents or,
exactly.
or people of other races.
Yeah, he in fact refused to baptize the Pharisees and the Sadducees that came to make a display.
Absolutely.
In front of everybody else. Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay, so now chapter 6, verse 1, you're saying that what this is telling us is it's the Judeans, the Judahites, who practice circumcision happen to be living among the Greeks. Okay.
Well, no. A lot of, they were living amongst the Greeks because the Greeks had colonized
right.
the Levant or Palestine.
Yes.
And a lot of from the Hellenistic period, which began with Alexander the Great, a lot of Judeans adopted Greek customs and habits.
Yes.
And those
yes.
people are the Hellenists of verse
yes.
1 in Acts chapter 6.
Okay. All right. Let me complete what it says here from the King James. There arose a murmuring of the Grecians against the Hebrews because their widows were neglected in the daily ministration. In other words, they were being receiving prejudicial treatment. They weren't being favored like the Hebrew women were. Okay, is that what your translation says?
Right, that's basically what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
The women following Hebrew customs were being favored more greatly than the women who were Hellenized, who were following Greek customs.
Right. Okay. So the wives were angry with each other, and so the men had to do something about it. Okay.
Right.
And all right.
Oddly, in verse 5, all 7 of the men chosen to administer this detail have Greek names.
Uh huh. Fascinating.
Every Philippus, Prochorus, Nicanor, Timon, Parmenas.
Yes.
Every one of those names is a Greek name with a Greek meaning.
Yes. Okay. Okay.
And that's fascinating that they were chosen by the people.
But only Nicholas was a so-called proselyte of
yes.
Antioch.
He's the only one. Being from Antioch, he may have been either a Greek by race or an Aramean, a Syrian.
Okay.
By race. Antioch was a famous, there were actually a couple of Antiochs. But it was basically a Syrian city.
Uh-huh.
And the Arameans were kindred of the Hebrews.
Yes.
So
exactly.
Nicholas was almost certainly an Adamite man.
Yes. Certainly one of the kings of Syria stated that the Syrians were cousins of the Hebrews. So they're of the same stock, the same gens.
Yes. But wherever we see the word Syrian in the Old Testament, the Hebrew word is Aram or Aramean,
mm-hmm.
and Aram in Genesis chapter 10 is a son of Shem.
Right.
Is the exactly. brother of Eber.
That's right. So they're brothers. They're kindred.
Yes.
So no doubt about it. Okay, so Nicholas the proselyte and these men who were called to be on this council to decide the issue, what happens? How did they decide the issue?
Well, they elected a council to control, to oversee this, the people elected, which is the way it should be,
mm-hmm.
these 7 men to oversee this this ministration to the widows.
Yes.
But the thing that's important here is that all these men are Judeans, even though they're called Grecians by
right.
the King James Version of the Bible.
Right. So they're Judeans who lived in Greek territory.
Well, they practiced Greek customs and habits.
Yes. Okay. Well, either or both.
Their
yes.
ancient Hebrew customs and habits.
Okay.
Now, in Acts chapter 8 at the end, we had the story of Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch.
Okay.
And a lot of universalists point right to this passage and claim that Christianity is for everybody. He's an Ethiopian.
Yes.
And a eunuch, and he was baptized and converted by Philip.
Right.
Now, if they read the text, they would find
okay.
that this Ethiopian went to the temple in Jerusalem to worship.
Yes.
And he was on his way back from the temple in Jerusalem from worshiping
mm-hmm.
when Philip met this man.
Okay.
Now, at the time, and this is well attested by archaeology, at the time, there were signs all around the temple in Jerusalem, in the inner court,
mm-hmm.
that anybody who entered the temple that was not a circumcised Judean
yes.
would be stoned to death.
Right.
The penalty was death.
Yes.
This Ethiopian, he wasn't an Ethiopian by race. He
yes.
was a Judean.
Exactly.
He happened to be working in the employment of Queen Candace, or Candace,
yes.
of Ethiopia.
Okay.
And there's a few interesting things going on in this one passage.
Oh, yeah.
First, he's reading Isaiah when Philip comes up to him. He's reading from the book of Isaiah.
Right.
A prophecy. And he's returning from the temple. He has to be an Ethiopian, a Judean man.
Right.
He's simply being called an Ethiopian because that's his
place of residence.
His habit, because he's working for the Ethiopian government.
Right.
In their employment. And so he's called an Ethiopian because he probably lives there. He's an Ethiopian
yeah.
by geography.
Well, just as Moses was an Israelite who was, became a high in Egypt.
Absolutely.
That doesn't make him an Egyptian by race. Yes.
Absolutely. He's,
yeah.
he's a Hebrew by race.
Exactly. Exactly.
And
go ahead.
Pointing to this passage and calling this man an Ethiopian by race and using
yeah.
that as an excuse to convert non-Judeans or non-Israelites into Christianity is
mm-hmm.
it's blasphemous.
It is.
Totally ignorant also.
Yes, it is. It absolutely
very clear
is.
When this passage is actually read that this man's a Judean man and he's under the employ of the queen of Ethiopia
right.
and lives there and therefore he's called an Ethiopian.
Yeah. So in other words, Philip accepts this man from Ethiopia as a brother, has no problem with it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because he's a Judean. He's
right.
on his way back from the temple.
Yes, yes.
He would have never been in Jerusalem to worship if he weren't.
Yes, and the non-Judeans were ordered. They could not enter the inner court. They had to stay in the outer court because the inner court was reserved exclusively for Israelites. And,
right. They
yeah,
couldn't go to Jerusalem and not to worship. They
right.
couldn't. They weren't admitted into the temple.
Right. Right. And so they could enter the outer court to do business, but they could not enter the inner court or the temple because that was reserved exclusively for Israelites and nobody else.
Absolutely.
Yes. Now,
the penalty of death.
Yes.
And there were signs. The signs have been found. The inscriptions have been found by
yeah.
archaeologists.
Okay.
They're famous inscriptions, and you could probably see them or models of them on display in Palestine today.
Right. Okay, very good. All right, so we could probably do a show on that subject. as an introduction to Acts chapter 10, it clarifies the relationship between the true Judeans, which were of the house and tribe of Judah, and, of course, Benjamin. And there were other tribes there as well that were included because if you're an Israelite, you can still marry a Judahite and be brought into the family of that tribe, okay?
Right, legitimately, right.
Yes, okay. So there probably were some members of other tribes there as well, but they had to be Israelites. And when I opened the show, I talked about Ezra and Nehemiah verifying the genealogy of the priests. And any priest who could not confirm his genealogy in the records at the temple was not admitted to the priesthood.
Right, he was put out. That's why Herod destroyed those records.
That's right, exactly, because he didn't want anybody to know that he wasn't a Judahite.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He was appointing all sorts of spurious priests.
Exactly, exactly. Okay, all right, let's go into Acts chapter 10. And I can't do 90 minutes today. You know, we can go, you know, 60 minutes and maybe a few minutes more, but I think we can cover Acts chapter 10 certainly within a half an hour, 45 minutes. So let me start reading, and then if you have if your translation you know, differs remarkably, or you know, if you can expound on this translation. Again, I'm reading from the King James, chapter 10, verse 1. There was a certain man in Caesarea called Cornelius, a centurion of the band called the Italian Band. Okay. First of all, we should say that Caesarea was a city that was actually built by Herod. Correct?
Yes, in honor of Caesar. He named it in honor of Caesar.
Right. And so in this town called Caesarea, we probably had a mixed multitude. We certainly had true Judahites. We certainly had Benjamites and probably members of all 12 tribes. But also
Canaanites.
Yes, plus Canaanites, exactly, exactly, who were the Herodians.
Right,
okay.
But this man being called a centurion of the cohort called Italian,
yes,
that betrays his race.
Right.
Because that signifies that, you see, the Romans would collect armies in given locations. They would collect legions, and they would never post them for duty in their homeland.
Mm-hmm.
They would always send them somewhere else.
Kind of like America is doing, right?
Right.
Under the Zionists.
But Roman legions were ethnically homogenous.
Right.
They collect they take legions from their German allies.
Uh-huh.
And they'd serve them in Judea. They would
right.
send them to serve in Judea.
Right.
Or in Britain. And vice versa. They take legions from Britain and send them to serve in Africa.
Exactly.
Or wherever.
Yeah.
And being called the centurion of the cohort called Italian means that this man, if he was not a Roman officer,
mm-hmm.
he was a Greek by race, because most of the inhabitants of Italy at the time were Greeks.
Okay.
The Greeks had heavily set, in fact, Lower Italy was called Magna Graecia by the Romans.
Uh-huh, okay.
It was called Italy, but it was Magna Graecia, means Greater Greece. There was so
yeah.
many Greeks there.
So the total victory of the Romans over the Greeks had really not manifested itself yet. And, of course, people spoke Greek. They didn't speak Italian.
Well, Greek was always the common language of Italy.
Yes.
Of even it was commonly spoken on the streets of Rome.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And Latin was the language of the Roman people, language, and government.
Yes.
But
so it took a while for Latin to displace.
Bilingual.
Yeah, it took a while for Latin to displace Greek in Rome, in Italy. Yes.
Right. Actually, the church facilitated that displacement.
Okay. Okay. All right. So verse 2, a devout man and one that feared God with all his house, which gave much alms to the people and prayed to God always. And so, in other words, we're being told that Cornelius was a very devout man, of course, man being a reference to Israelites, and that he practiced the law of Moses. Isn't that what we're being told here?
No, it just means that we can't be read this to mean that he practiced the law of Moses because
okay.
he was devout. It means that he was a man who, he wasn't a circumcised Judean.
Okay.
That is what is peculiar about Acts chapter 10 and the reason why Peter needed his vision.
Yes.
Because this man is not circumcised.
Okay.
He's not a Judean.
Right.
And
okay.
the Judeans, they gauged you by whether or not you were circumcised and kept the laws of Moses.
Right. Now, what's interesting.
Anyone
yes.
who did not have circumcision or keep the laws of Moses was considered a swine.
Right. Right. It's like Germans disliking Brits, right? And
absolutely.
Vice versa. Exactly.
They were considered unclean men.
Yes.
And it doesn't matter what their race was.
Uh-huh.
They were considered unclean men.
Right. So we have xenophobia being manifested among brethren against brethren.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And Petros is caught up in that, and that's why he needed his vision.
Right. Now, it's interesting that Cornelius also has a vision. The way this chapter reads, it sounds like Cornelius and Peter had their visions simultaneously. Okay? Verse 3, this is referring to Cornelius. He saw in a vision, evidently about the ninth hour of the day, an angel of God coming into him and saying to him, Cornelius. And when he looked on him, he was afraid and said, What is it, Lord? And he said to him, Your prayers and your alms are come up for a memorial before God. Fascinating. Verse 5, And now send men to Joppa and call for one Simon, whose surname is Peter. So Cornelius has a vision from Yahweh before or virtually the same time that Peter, right?
Well, Cornelius' vision would have been the day before.
The day before, okay.
And it would have taken at least a full day and maybe two to,
uh-huh.
to get from Caesarea to Joppa.
Okay.
It's a pretty long trip down the coast.
Okay, okay.
And it would have been a couple of days' travel probably. So Cornelius' vision preceded Peter's.
Okay, all right. But he had a vision, Cornelius had a vision, and then Peter had a corresponding vision. The two visions are related. Okay.
Peter has his, right, exactly. And Peter has his vision just before the men whom Cornelius sent for him showed up.
Right. Okay, so verse 6, he lodges with one Simon a tanner, who's not Simon Peter, Simon a tanner, whose house is by the seaside. He shall tell you what you ought to do. This is angel still speaking to Cornelius. And when the angel which spoke to Cornelius was departed, he called two of his household servants and a devout soldier of them that waited on him continually. And when he had declared all these things to them, he sent them to Joppa. Okay. Your translation, anything extraordinary here?
No, this is pretty straight in the King James.
Okay. So, yeah, there are times when the King James just gets it right, but the interpreters get it all wrong. Verse 9, on the morrow, as they went on their journey and they drew near to the city, Peter went up upon the housetop to pray about the sixth hour, which would be 12 noon. Verse 10, and he became very hungry. Okay, so his hunger apparently is literal. And if you're hungry, you can dream about food. and would have eaten, but while he had made ready, he fell into a trance. Okay, is trance the correct translation here?
Yes.
Okay. So he fell into a trance. So obviously, he's in an altered state of consciousness here as he received this vision. Verse 11, and he saw heaven opened and a certain vessel descending to him, as it had been a great sheet knit at the four corners and let down to the earth, wherein were all manner of four-footed beasts of the earth and wild beasts and creeping things and fowls of the air. Okay, so far, if we take this literally, it sounds like the vision has to deal with literal animals, okay? Anything in these two verses from your translation that would suggest otherwise?
No, it looks like literal animals, and that's what it says. And,
yes.
But we have to understand that this is a vision.
It's a vision. Okay.
And items in a vision are usually symbolic.
Right. Dreams are usually symbolic, not literal. Yes.
Right. The entire revelation to John was given in visions, as
yes.
John admits and,
yes.
and as he records.
Yes.
And all of the revelation is given in symbols.
Yes. Just about all the prophecies are, too. Most of the
right.
prophecies are not literal. Some of them are, some of them aren't. You know, we have to be very careful to distinguish the two, okay? All right, so verse 13, and here is where it really sounds like this is talking about literal food. And there came a voice to him, Rise, Peter, kill and eat. Okay? Any indication in the Greek words here for kill and eat that they have a broader connotation than literal killing and eating?
No, it's basically that's what it means, except that the word that is kill
yes.
is actually, it insinuates a sacrifice, sacrificial killing,
mm-hmm.
which is the only distinction
okay.
that can be made from the King James.
Okay, so in other words, sacrifice and eat.
Yes.
Okay.
Which is how I translate it.
Interesting. Okay, so verse 14, but Peter said, not so, Lord. For I have never eaten anything that is common or unclean. And this is a reference back to Leviticus 11:4, which proves, for example, that the true Judeans, you know, the true Judahites, were still practicing the, you know, the literal law of the Levitical priesthood, even after, you know, the sacrifice on the cross. All right?
Absolutely.
Yes. Yes. Okay, verse...
The,
yes.
The, well, the... common or profane, the two words, the word can be translated either way.
Uh-huh.
There's a distinction between common or profane foods and unclean foods.
Oh, okay.
All right? The distinction is this. A food that's common or profane was killed outside of and handled outside of the rituals that the Judeans or the ancient Hebrews use
to
kill food.
All right. So it wasn't kosher.
It may have been killed by a heathen and on the altar of a strange god.
Right.
That would be considered common or profane.
Yes.
Even if it was something that wasn't unclean.
Right.
Something unclean is one of the forbidden forms of life.
Exactly.
Like a pig would be unclean. A pig can be common and profane, but it's always going to be unclean.
Right. So a cut of beef that was blessed by to an idol would be profane.
Profane or common, right.
But not unclean.
Right.
Okay. Very interesting. Okay, verse 15. And the voice spoke to him again the second time, what God has cleansed, that call not you common or profane, right?
Right.
Okay.
Do not deem it profane.
Yeah, and so now we can see this must have caused some tremendous confusion in Peter's mind because obviously, he knows he's not supposed to eat common. He probably habitually did not eat profane food and certainly did not eat unclean food.
Right, but the entire key to understanding Peter's vision are the words, the things which Yahweh has cleansed.
Uh-huh.
What has
he
God cleansed?
Yes.
And when you look back into the prophets, it's over and over again in Isaiah, in Ezekiel, in Jeremiah, Yahweh tells Israel, I will clean you.
Yes.
I will cleanse you of your sin.
Right.
And everywhere it talks about the cleansing of sin through the sacrifice performed by Yahshua Christ on the cross, it's only promised to Israel.
Right. And certainly
it's only talking to Israel.
Yes. And certainly the universalists, having none of this in mind, what you just described, having none of this in mind, simply assume that it's talking about other people.
Because the universalists take a Black and Decker sawzall and they chop the New Testament off from the old.
That's right. That's right. Okay, verse 16. This was done thrice. Okay, this voice told him three times. Okay, this whole vision was repeated three times, and the vessel.
Peter needed that.
Pardon?
Peter needed that.
Yes, he needed to be retold.
Peter was the most stubborn of apostles.
Yes.
He had to be told at the end of John to feed my sheep.
As are the universalists today. Very stubborn.
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay, this was done thrice, and the vessel was received up again into heaven. So this vision, this whole scenario repeated itself two more times, so Peter would really start to think about what is the meaning of this, okay, which is described in verse 17. Now, while Peter doubted in himself what this vision which he had seen should mean, behold, the men which were sent from Cornelius had made inquiry for Simon's house and stood before the gate. So while he was having this vision, those men from Joppa arrived at his doorstep.
And that shows that the vision isn't talking about Peter's lunch.
Yes.
Because Simon the Tanner... Peter, if Simon the Tanner is not a Judean living by the law, Peter's not going to eat in his house.
That's right.
Because then he would have put common or profane things into his mouth.
Right. Okay, so what we're talking about here in verse 17 is Peter is a circumcised Judean. Cornelius is not. Yet Peter is now has thrust upon him the concept that he should accept an uncircumcised Judean into his house.
Right, or uncircumcised Adamite.
Or Israelite, yes.
You can't tell, there were many Thracians, and there were probably Thracians in the blood of the Romans. The Romans descended from the Trojans.
Yes.
But the Trojans lived amongst the Japhethite Thracians.
Mm-hmm, okay.
And the Thracian nations, the people of descended from Tyrus. Thracian is a a descendant of Japheth.
Yes.
In Genesis chapter 10.
Okay.
And from him descended the Thracians, from whom came the Phrygians.
Okay.
And there was another group of Shemites living in the Troad called the Lydians.
Okay.
From whom came the Etruscans.
All right.
And all these people had very much in common and lived amongst each other in both the Troad,
yes,
like, and in Italy.
Yes. Okay.
And there was surely much intermingling amongst them.
Yes. And what was their common language before Greek? Any idea?
No, but there's a lot of evidence that ancient Trojan and the ancient language of Thrace had a lot of in common with Latin.
Okay.
And that they were closely related.
Okay.
And that the Latin may have actually developed out of it. There are a lot of loan words or a lot of common words with Latin and Greek, but there are also many, many, many different words,
yes,
that have nothing in common at all and mean the same thing.
Yes, okay. And then certainly a lot of Hebrew words as well.
Oh, yeah. I could find hundreds of Hebrew words in both Latin and Greek.
Okay. All right.
And they're words that the Greek word for market is agora. That's the same exact word as the Hebrew word for market.
Okay.
But the Greeks must have had a word for market.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, there's a lot of words that are so plain and simple that they must have just kept the same words as they traveled.
Right, right. Okay.
Rather than be loan words. It's a long story to talk about language. I don't want to spend too
much
time on it here.
Right, okay. But you're establishing the case that the Trojans, Lydians, Thracians, etc., are all a related Adamite people.
Right, and this man, it would be hard for Peter to tell,
yes,
whether he was an Israelite.
Yeah, because he looked like an Israelite.
Right, but he could have been an Ionian Greek, and they are also Japhethites.
Right.
Javan in Genesis chapter 10.
Yes.
It's beyond doubt that Javan is the ancestor of the Ionian Greeks, because the Persian inscriptions call the Ionians Yavana.
Okay.
Okay, it's the same word as the Hebrew Javan. There's no J.
Yes.
It's Yavan.
Right.
And that's what the Ionian Greeks are clearly labeled,
mm-hmm,
in front of the Histon Rock.
Yeah, and so they were descended through Japheth, who was a brother of Shem.
Right.
Obviously kindred.
And it would have been next to impossible for Peter to tell the Japhethite Greeks and Romans.
Yes.
And Romans and Trojans from the Israelite Greeks.
Exactly, exactly. Just as, you know, in fact, I was just thinking today, one of my relatives here in Chicago, who's also of German descent, she, her name is Lily, and I was just thinking about the Andrews sisters, you know, who did that boogie woogie song about the boogie woogie bugle boy from Company D. Well, she looks just like them, you know. I mean, she could be an Andrews sister, you know. So they're Brits, and she's German, and they look exactly alike, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. All right, so let's go to 18, and called and asked whether Simon, which was surnamed Peter, were lodgers. So they were looking for him. Do you think that that Cornelius and his troop had an inkling that they were Hebrews?
No, they had no inkling, because they did not have the benefits of archaeology that we have.
Yes.
And they, even though there's a lot in common between the religion of Rome and the religion of the Hebrews and the beliefs of Rome and the
yes,
Romans and the beliefs of the Hebrews. I mean, Jove is basically Yahweh.
That's right.
It's the Semitic equivalent of Yahweh.
Yes. And if you pronounce it in the original language, it's Yahweh.
Yes,
not
absolutely.
Jove.
Or Yahweh or Yahweh.
Yes.
Or
yes. Exactly.
Yes, it's not Jove. There's no J sound in it. Whether there's a V sound is debatable.
Yes.
And we're not sure if Caesar, when he crossed the Rubicon, said Zany Zidi Vici or Wainy Weedy Weedy.
Yeah, right.
So it may have been Yo There or Yo Where.
Yes.
We don't really know.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay, verse 19. While Peter thought on the vision. Okay, so these people appear at his doorstep, and he's still thinking about the vision. While Peter thought on the vision, the Spirit said to him, "Behold, three men seek you. Arise, therefore, and get you down and go with them, doubting nothing, for I have sent them.
Right, and that absolutely proves that the vision is of the unclean beast is about uncircumcised.
It's about men. It's not about beasts, it's about men.
Right, and anybody that understands the prophecy of the Hebrew prophets can take that what Yahweh has cleansed and understand that these men, whether Peter was cognizant of it or not, these men were certainly Israelites of the dispersion.
That's right. Absolutely.
And the Romans can be traced, and I have an essay on the topic,
yes,
back to the Trojans,
right,
from there to Judah's era.
Okay, well, actually, since you mentioned that, why don't you announce your website address again? Because I understand you're getting all these articles online now.
Yes, all of my classical records articles are online, and my entire Paul translation is online.
Okay.
And my entire Luke translation is online.
Outstanding. All right.
John and Matthew and Mark and James and Jude and Peter will have to wait probably until mid-March.
Okay, all right.
The website is Christogenia.org, Christogenia.org.
Okay, Christogenia.org. Okay, verse
That's
20.
It. No www or
yeah,
anything
to,
like that.
Yeah, you don't have to use that anymore. Yes. Okay, verse 21. Then Peter went down to the men which were sent to him from Cornelius and said, Behold, I am he whom you seek. What is the cause why you are come? And they said, Cornelius the centurion, a just man, and one that fears God and of good report among all the nation of the Judeans, it says Jews in the King James, it should be Judeans,
yes,
was warned from God by a holy angel to send for you into his house and to hear words of you. Okay, so for people who are not aware that the Greek word Judeos is translated from the word Judean, or which means of a country, it does not speaking specifically of the house of Judah necessarily, or of the Jews necessarily either. It's a translation of a word which means a citizen of a country or the inhabitant of a country. It is not necessarily a racial term, correct?
Correct.
Yes.
Because it encompassed a lot of different races, the Edomites, the Israelites, various other Canaanites.
Right.
Aramaeans, Greek, yes. Romans, a lot of people lived in Judea.
Right. And the reason why the King James Version has the word Jews in here is because the Jewish people, the rabbis of Judaism, want people to believe that they're the only people in Judea that can be represented from Judea, because they want to equate themselves with the Judahites when, in fact, they are not.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's why it says Jews. It's a trick. It's a trick word. Okay, verse 23. Then called he them in and lodged them. And this would be a tremendous thing for him to do, considering the fact that he thought they were foreigners. Right?
Yes, absolutely. So he must have understood the vision.
Yes. He was told by the angel, do not refuse them. Don't doubt anything, for I have sent them. Okay? But obviously he's still confused. And on the morrow, Peter went away with them, and certain brethren from Joppa accompanied him. And the morrow after they entered into Caesarea, and Cornelius waited for them and had called together his kinsmen and near friends. Of course, that's Cornelius's near kinsmen and friends. So, and verse 25, and as Peter was coming in, Cornelius met him and fell down at his feet and worshipped him. Divergences here?
The only thing that's divergent really isn't important. It really says that Cornelius invited together his kinsmen and the necessary friends.
Necessary friends. Okay.
I take that to mean, you know, when you have a wedding,
yes,
or a funeral, there are people that you are in your circle that whether
right.
they're your friends or not, you just have to invite them to
that's
the
right. Otherwise they'll be insulted.
Yes, and that's what that means.
Okay. Whether you like them or not.
Right.
Okay. All right. Now, verse 26, but Peter took him up, saying, Stand up, I myself also am a man. And as he talked with him, he went in and found many that were come together, So here he is, Peter, a circumcised Judean, now in the company of all these uncircumcised dispersion Israelites. And wow, what am I doing among these people? Verse 28. And then he said to them, you know how that it is an unlawful thing for a man that is a Judean to keep company or come to one of another nation. But God has showed me that I should not call any man common or unclean. Verse 28 clearly says that Peter understands that his vision has showed to him that he should not call these foreigners of the dispersion unclean. Is not that,
that he did not have a ham sandwich for lunch that
day. That's right. How can you misunderstand verse 28?
They take two or three verses out of context. They show the congregation that they're there. The congregation looks. They don't read the whole story, and they're
right.
told to eat pork.
Right, exactly. So instead of reading this whole story, which it's a very fascinating story of two visions to two different men coming together at the same point in space and time, and they will take verse 13, and there came a voice to him, rise, Peter, kill, and eat. Then they will jump to verse 28, and he said to them, you know, that is a lawful thing for a man who is a Jew, of course they'll translate it as Jew, to keep company or come to one of another nation, but God has showed me that I should not call him any man a common or unclean. Well, even if you jump directly from 13 to 28, Peter's saying, I should not call any man common or unclean. He doesn't say beast.
Right, but mainstream pastors jump directly from 13 to lunch.
Yes.
They skip 28.
Okay, lunchtime, folks. Incredible. It's absolutely incredible.
This also proves that the Ethiopian eunuch was a Judean.
Okay.
And that the Grecians of Acts chapter 6 were Judeans, were simply practicing Greek customs. And because this is where, this is the turning point, this is the linchpin of Scripture where the Christianity becomes a religion for all the dispersed Israelites.
Right, exactly.
Whether or not they're circumcised.
Yes.
That's what Peter's being told.
Yes.
That's what Peter's being told here.
Yes.
That which Yahweh has cleansed.
Yes.
Peter is not, he's a simple man from Galilee. He's
mm-hmm.
a fisher.
Yes.
He doesn't know any more except that he was with Christ. He was with Yahshua for 3.5 years.
Yes.
But up to that point, he didn't know any more than the average Jerry Springer
right.
guest.
Exactly.
About
okay.
history and,
yes.
and race and the promises of the Bible.
All right. Let me jump to verse 34 because this seems also to fly in the face of the exclusivist message of Christian Israel. Verse 34. Then Peter opened his mouth and said, of a truth, I perceive that God is no respecter of persons.
And okay. that term, a lot of people try to take that term and make it a racial term.
Okay.
But that's not what it means, and that's not a good translation.
Okay.
James chapter 2 defines that term. It means a respect of the status or stature of persons.
Okay, right.
It has nothing to do with race. It has everything to do with money and,
right.
and position in society.
So, in other words, a poor man would get the same justice in a proper court that a rich man would.
Right.
That's what it really means, right?
Right. And this Cornelius, his particular position is just that, in Peter's eyes, is simply that he's not circumcised.
Right, right. So, in other words, again, the universalist interpretation is that this proves God is no respecter of different races.
Right, but that's not what it's saying. It's saying, it's talking about the stature of persons.
Yes, yes. And so it basically means our common law understanding that whoever comes before a judge, let's say, his wealth, his status, all those things are to be disregarded and they're considered equal.
Right, and James chapter 2 uses the same Greek words, and it shows that it's talking about status and wealth and position in society and not about
yes. So it can't be interpreted to say that blacks and Orientals and Jews
right.
should
well,
be welcomed into the fold.
They're not persons.
Right. Not under this definition. Absolutely not. Yes. Okay.
They're
verse
not,
20,
but Yahweh is cleansed.
That's right. That's yeah. Yahweh only cleansed Israel. Isn't
right.
Yeah. Because only Israel broke the law.
Right.
Only Israel was given the law.
Absolutely. Cleansing
yes.
is a subject of prophecy, and it's only prophesied for Israel.
Yes, yes.
Period.
Okay. Yes, absolutely. All of this, and in the works of Paul, he always prefaces his letters with references back to the Old Testament talking about their Israelite heritage.
Absolutely.
He never includes non-Israelites in his discussions.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Every one of his letters, and we could go through them one at a time if you want and
yes.
point out all of that language.
Right. Well, let me jump
it's
to verse.
It's a lot stronger in Greek than it is in the King James Version.
Yes, yes. Okay. Let me jump to verse 40. Him God raised up on the third day, referring to Christ, and showed him openly, not to all the people, but to witnesses chosen before of God, even to us who did eat and drink with him after he rose from the dead. So this language is terribly exclusive compared to the false interpretation of the universalist half of verse 34, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, okay. Okay, so we're approaching the end of the hour. Do you have anything for us of significance in Acts chapter 10? And then we can talk about, you know, what we'll discuss next week.
Well, I think that we've actually... we've pretty much covered everything that we should say. Not everything that could be said, but everything
yes.
we should say.
Yes.
And I can't think of anything to add to it offhand, except
okay.
that Yahshua Christ prophesied universalism.
Oh, he prophesied universalism?
He prophesied universalism.
How do you mean?
When he said that the kingdom of heaven is like a net.
Okay.
When cast into a sea, it would pick up all different manners of fishes.
Oh, right, yes.
And or kinds of fishes. And that word, translated kind, is genos.
Yes.
Which you defined at the beginning of this segment.
Right.
The word means race.
It does, yes.
Or species. All
yes.
different species or races of fishes.
Yes. Now you're referring to the...
come and gather the good race,
yes.
or genos, and keep it in vessels.
Yes, yes.
And the bad race... or genos of fishes would be thrown into the fire and destroyed.
That's the when he pulled the net in, there were 153 fishes, and instead of keeping all the fishes, he only kept some and threw the rest away. Right?
well, that's a prophecy of universalism. That's what he says. The kingdom of heaven is like a net.
Yes. Yes.
And it takes up all the fish.
Right. Right.
And a lot of those fish don't belong.
Yeah, and they won't all enter the kingdom either. Okay.
And he knew that this was going to happen.
Yes. In verse 45, we have one of these usages of the word Gentile. Let me read it. And they of the circumcision, and now this really establishes the fact that we're talking about the uncircumcision versus the circumcision. Okay. And they of the circumcision which believed were astonished, as many as came with Peter, because that on the Gentiles also was poured out the gift of the Holy Ghost. Now, of course, the Jews define this word Gentile to mean non-Jews or non-Israelites from
and
their
that's
perspective.
That's what it means. It simply means of to the nations.
Yes.
The other nations of the oikoumene.
Right.
The most liberal definition or interpretation of the way this word is used here.
Yes.
And
yes.
and that means the other white Adamic nations of their world, or oikoumene
right.
means their living space.
Okay.
And it doesn't mean the Chinese, because China's not part of the oikoumene.
Right, right.
It doesn't mean the Indians or the Africans. It means the people in Greco-Roman society.
Yes. And isn't it true that the word Gentile, which is actually a Latin-French word, doesn't that mean kinsman or something similar to kinsman, not foreigner, as
well,
the Jews use it?
When Jerome took this word, this Greek word ethnos,
yes,
and translated it into Latin, there were several different words that he could have used.
Okay.
There were several different Latin words, natus or gentilis or even mundo, which means the world.
Okay.
But he chose gentilis. And
okay.
Gentilis means basically someone of another nation who's related to you.
Okay.
In other words,
a relative.
Right. A Trojan or a Greek could be related to a Roman very closely by race.
Yes.
That perception can be made.
Yeah.
But an Ethiopian can't.
Yes.
He wouldn't be a gentilis.
Right. Right. Unless he was a gentilis like Philip. Who was the Ethiopian eunuch again? What was his name?
He's not given a name, but he's,
oh, he wasn't?
He's a no. He's definitely a Judean.
That's right.
And that's the point I tried to make. He was
right.
Returning from the temple.
So in essence,
Isaiah.
Yeah. So the word gentilis really means a kinsman who lives in a foreign nation.
Well, it means a foreign nation, but a person who's related.
Mm-hmm.
A related nation, not just any
okay.
foreign nation.
Okay.
It's the perception of race and nation in the Greek world is the opposite of our perception.
Right. Okay.
And it's a difficult hurdle to jump.
Yes.
But to the Greeks, genos was a subdivision of ethnos.
Okay.
To us, ethnos or nation is a subdivision of genos or race.
Right. So we got the concept reversed.
Right.
Yeah.
We see the Danes and the German, the various German nations,
yes.
because there's actually different tribes inhabiting Germany.
Yes.
The English, the Irish, we see them as all the same race divided into different nations.
Yes.
The Greeks saw a nation, like as an example, the Dorian Greeks inhabited many different cities.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all Dorian Greeks. But the Greeks perceived them as really different races.
Okay.
In one nation.
Yes.
It's the concept is very different.
Right, right.
And when you read Greek, you really have to wind yourself around a corner to turn that over.
Right, yeah, I understand.
At the same time.
Yeah, I understand. Isn't it true, then, that basically all these nations were very race conscious, and as because of their race consciousness, they fought against each other, even though they were of the same race, didn't realize it, they didn't have that concept.
Well, Strabo, who wrote while Christ was a child, I mean, Strabo died in 25 AD.
Okay.
He was the most famous of Greek geographers, and he marveled that Egypt was the only place where people of different races inhabited the same cities.
Yes.
And he makes special mention of that and marvels at that because in the whole Greek world, every city was inhabited by a single race of people.
So,
and a race was seen as a division of a tribe or nation.
Right. So if there was any multiculturalism in those days, it was among people of the white race, not multiracial.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
And even then, even people of the white race from two different tribes would inhabit two different cities. They
yes.
would live in the same city.
Right, and they had different customs, different practices, yet they were actually kindred and didn't realize it.
Right.
Yeah. Now, contrasting that to Egypt, where there was indeed a multiracial form of multiculturalism going on.
Yes, Egypt had already become a melting pot, and that's why it's one of the most decadent nations in the world.
Right, exactly. And they refused to let us look at those mummies and investigate the ancient history of Egypt, which clearly shows that the original pharaohs were white, not Arab.
Absolutely. They're very embarrassed about it.
Yes.
Their past.
Yeah, that's
but
why
a lot of stuff gets out. It's beyond their control. I've seen many funerary masks and statues from early Egyptian dynasties where people clearly have white skin and blue eyes.
Yes, exactly. Okay, and then as my guest last Sunday, Suzanne Olson pointed out, because she's looked at these mummies, she's examined these grave sites, et cetera, and she says they're all Aryan white men. They're not of any other race. The Israelites and Hebrews were white men, plain and simple. Correct.
Right.
Yes.
And that's the Bible itself proves that the Israelites are white men, but the Bible is not a book about biology or anthropology or and because of the Hebrew law, the prohibition against images, the evidence is very scant as to what they look like, and the Jews take advantage of that.
Yes.
But it's in Lamentations. It's in the Song of Solomon. He was clearly a white man with raven or black hair, ivory skin, and ruddy cheeks.
Right. And so was
that's
David.
The way King Solomon is described
right.
in the Song of Solomon.
And the word ruddy means to show blood in the face.
Yes. And
yes.
David, Solomon's father, is described as being ruddy.
Yes.
In the books of Samuel.
Yes. Yeah.
There is no doubt that these are white men. They're not Arab-looking men like the Jews would have us believe. The Shemites, the Arabs are not Shemites, and that's one of the biggest lies extant today. It's almost as big a lie as the Jews being Israel.
Yes.
The fact the Arabs, the word Arab is a Hebrew word which means to become mixed.
Right.
Now, the verb can also mean to grow dark.
Okay.
How do people grow dark? And this is evident right from a Strong's Concordance. I'm going to take a second.
Okay.
And look up the actual Strong's Concordance numbers so that people can understand this word. And I think it's in the 1,000 range. Actually, it's 10.
Okay. The word Arab you're looking for?
Yeah,
it does mean, it means mixed and to grow dark. Yes, that's my understanding too.
Yes, and there's no, that's, the word means mixed. They can't be Shemites.
Right.
If they mix, what are they mixed with? Well, we have to go back and really look at ancient history in the Bible to understand that, but it goes back to those Canaanite races and the black races that surrounded the Oikoumene, the Nubians, the Dravidians in India, and there were probably races early in Arabian history that resembled those people.
Yes, yes. Okay, let's continue. Let's pick another theme. I don't know if we have something. Is there something on top of your head that we can discuss next time? Unless you want to go into the two seed line topic right away.
Well, you wanted to discuss Deuteronomy chapter 23:7, is it?
Yes. Okay.
Where it says that thou shalt not abhor an Edomite.
Oh, right. Absolutely. Yes.
Which is not what it should say. It should say, thou shalt not abhor an Aramean, a Syrian, actually, because he is your brother. And that's what it should probably say, and we can give a good demonstration that interpretation would be extremely plausible based upon confusion between certain Hebrew letters by the scribes.
Yes.
And the fact that Yahweh hated Edomites. He wouldn't tell the Israelites not to hate them. David hated Yahweh's enemies with a perfect hatred, and he was a man after God's own heart. The book of Malachi says that explicitly that Yahweh hated Esau.
Yes.
And
yes.
Paul in Romans chapter 9 quotes that.
Mm-hmm.
So now if the passage in Deuteronomy should say, thou shalt not abhor an Edomite, then what is Paul doing in Romans chapter 9?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a clear conflict there, and the only way it can be explained is that the scribes confused two letters in the passage in Deuteronomy, and we can clearly show this.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That these letters were often confused, and I have many examples of these letters being confused.
Yes, yes. And so Clifton Emheiser showed that word is not Edom at all. It's an entirely different word. So why don't we do that next Friday? Yes.
Yes, we can do that.
Excellent. Okay.
And then maybe get this two-seed line the week after.
Yes. All right, I have to get ready for my Rick Adams show. So, Bill Fink, I thank you for being, on this initial installment of Christogenos. Let's do this again next Friday night. Okay?
Praise Ellie.
Praise Ellie. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.